In 2022, it was estimated that 8.4 million South Africans live with HIV. In the US, that number is closer to 1.2 million people. Access to diagnostic methods, medication for treatment, and management guidelines differ between these two settings. So today, we're going to focus on HIV in the US setting, and we're going to have a follow-up episode which focuses on the South African setting. This is Microbe Mail, and I'm your host, Vindana Chibabai. I'm also joined by my right-hand virologist and co-host, Ruwan Marais. How are you doing today, Ruwan?
Hi. Doing very well. I'm excited to hear about the Global North and HIV.
Wonderful. I'm also really honored to be joined by Dr. Ankita Kadakia. Ankita, it's really awesome to have you joining us today. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here. I'm currently the Deputy Public Health Officer for the County of San Diego, which is located in California in the U.S. But I'm also an infectious disease physician with a specialty in HIV medicine, as well as tuberculosis. And so I've worked at our university here, University of California, San Diego, for several years. Seeing HIV and AIDS patients, as well as managing co-infections, including coccidiomycosis, tuberculosis, and a variety of other infectious diseases. And then I became the chief of tuberculosis and refugee health for this county of approximately 4.3 million people. And then during COVID, helped to manage our COVID-19 response here, and then currently the deputy public health officer. So thank you for having me.
We're really honored to have you joining us from the other end of the world. And I believe it's morning where you are, and we're sitting out here in the dark, and it's the evening on our side.
Different kinds of drinks, I imagine, are occurring here.
Very different kinds of drinks, yes. Okay, so before we get into our episode, just a couple of reminders for our listeners. Remember to sign up for updates on the Microbe Mail website. We usually send out email reminders every time we release a new episode. You can also follow us on your favorite podcast player of choice. Follow us on social media. You'll find Microbe Mail on Twitter, Instagram, as well as Facebook. And all of our team members also have LinkedIn profiles, so you'll find us there as well. Remember, if you haven't already, please pull out that 5-star rating from your pocket and share it for Microbe Mail. And lastly, we'd like to ask you to share Microbe Mail content with your colleagues, friends, and anyone who you think might be interested in this contagious content. Okay, everybody, are we ready to go?
Yes. Ready.
Wonderful. Ruwan, I'm going to hand over the reins to you, and you can start firing the questions first.
All right, so let's start at the beginning. How do you make the diagnosis of HIV in the USA? Are 2 point of care tests sufficient?
That's a great question. Usually we make the diagnosis in different ways, but the most common and preferred method is the fourth generation antigen antibody combination. It's an HIV-1 and HIV-2 differentiation immunoassay. We usually just refer to it as an ELISA test. This assay detects both HIV-1 and HIV-2 antibodies and P24 antigen. We do have point-of-care tests, usually in our emergency room settings, and some clinics may have them, and we refer to these as point-of-care or rapid tests. And these are usually antibody-based, but we would still need to have a confirmatory test, such as that fourth-generation ELISA test.
Okay.
Great. Thanks very much. So when you do the rapid test, do you then add on another 2 ELISA tests, or would you follow up with just a single ELISA test?
If it's a fourth generation ELISA test, it would just be that single test. It's okay. The reflex confirmatory test. If we're using a third generation ELISA test, that can still be a confirmatory test, but that test is, you know, antibody based. So we switched a few years back actually to this fourth generation test.
Right. Okay, So then the next question is, how would you approach a patient with an undetectable viral load and equivocal serological testing for HIV?
Yeah, this is a scenario I've definitely been in. And I think the first thing to do here is to talk about risk. You know, what is the usually I'd consider a risk-based approach. You know, if it's an individual who is or recently is engaged in high-risk behavior, such as certain sexual activities, we would repeat the viral load in 1 to 2 weeks. But then, you know, we also want to make sure that we're definitely ruling out early or acute HIV infection. I think this was more of a problem when we were reliant on our third generation test, but with the fourth generation ELISA test, so I'll back up a little. The third generation antibody test, the issue here is this we consider an older screening test, and it could catch HIV as early as 4 weeks after exposure. So we would still have that window period, you know, between exposure to 4 weeks where someone may have not developed antibodies yet, but they could still, you know, have contracted HIV. With an undetectable viral load, we could check for a P24 antigen if we were using that third generation antibody. With fourth generation ELISA testing, it's already built in. So, you know, we're looking for antibody and an antigen reaction. And so if we have this indeterminate test, it's a little bit different because it's a two-step process to eliminate that indeterminate testing. And so we don't often run into this situation anymore. But it, you know, depending on the patient and the availability, what's available at our hospital or clinic, if they didn't have that fourth generation test and it was a third generation ELISA test, they could just do a P24 antigen or consider repeating that viral load in 1 to 2 weeks, since we know viral load usually peaks about 10 days after someone has contracted HIV.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. So let's say you followed up this result and your patient that's now sitting in front of you ultimately tests negative. So you've done the follow-up testing, it's come back negative, the risks were low. Would you consider offering this person PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis? And if so, what regimen do you currently use in the US?
Yeah, so PrEP has really evolved, I think, over the last, you know, 5 years. And I used to run a PrEP clinic, and I think, you know, this is a great question. We usually, the CDC here had changed its guidelines and, you know, recommended PrEP for anyone who's sexually active. But we usually offer it to individuals who test negative for HIV but are high risk for contracting HIV. So there's particular categories, for instance, men who have sex with men and transgender women who report sexual behaviors that may be associated with HIV infection. And for instance, I'd say the highest risk is condomless anal sex. And then individuals who have had a documented bacterial STD, usually within the last 6 months, or and most recently with mpox or monkeypox, if they were diagnosed with another infection that we don't normally consider an STI, but we know can be transmitted in that way, then we would offer PrEP. We also consider it for heterosexual individuals who either have a sex partner who is HIV positive or at high risk of HIV. So for instance, I might have a patient who's HIV negative, but their partner is an intravenous drug user. So we know that is a high risk activity. So we would want to prescribe PrEP for that individual. And of course, the partner as well, an individual who's injecting drugs. And then the other times that I've used it is with partners of HIV positive individuals, and the HIV positive partner had a detectable viral load or their HIV status was unknown. And then the regimens we use, well, this has definitely changed over time, but what's currently approved is emtricitabine and tenofovir disoproxil fumarate. We call that Truvada here, or otherwise FTC-TDF. We also can use Descovy, which is emtricitabine plus tenofovir alafenamide, or, and this will depend on insurance coverage here, and how much the out-of-pocket cost to the patient is. But there is cabotegravir, long-acting cabotegravir as well. Truvada would be the cheapest and easiest to attain of all these medications. Probably between Truvada and Descovy is the most prescribed for PrEP.
So that was a nice little summary of PrEP there. But I've heard some interesting things about injectable PrEP. Ankita, can you tell us what's on the horizon in that regard?
Yes, so injectable PrEP, and actually only injectable that we have, was approved, I think, back in 2021 here in the United States. So we do have cabotegravir long-acting for injectable PrEP. But I think the barrier here really is insurance coverage and cost to the patient. This can be a much more expensive option for individuals who don't have private insurance. You know, here in the United States, we don't have universal health care. So individuals usually have their own health insurance or a state-provided health insurance. Or depending on their age, they may have insurance that is provided by our federal government.
Mm-hmm.
But depending on what the health insurance is, that will, you know, determine if they could use a long-acting injectable PrEP. And this PrEP is different, you know, from an oral tablet such as Descovy or Truvada, which would be taken every day. This is it's an every 2 month injection, and you receive an injection, you know, initiation, and then you repeat it again in 1 month, and then again in 2 months, and then you go to an every 2 month schedule.
Okay. Do you find that it's quite well tolerated, the injectable PrEP?
I think so. I mean, I think just like other injections, you know, local site reaction or, you know, pain, maybe at the where you've injected it in the upper arm, usually it's intramuscular injection. And then like with any other antiretroviral, you know, we can always have similar side effects like nausea or upset, you know, stomach or headache or not feeling well. But in general, I think it's well tolerated.
Okay. So I'm just going to change the scenario a little bit. So still sitting with our patient, patient tests negative, but reports that they had a high risk exposure about 12 hours ago, not occupational. How would you approach post-exposure prophylaxis in the US? And would that extend to other pathogens as well? Or are we only going to target HIV?
Great question. And I, you know, I hate this scenario because I never want anyone to be exposed to HIV, but we do come across this scenario. And so for non-occupational PEP, or we call NPEP, we provide NPEP for high-risk exposures, usually within 72 hours of the exposure. Besides HIV, we do also test for viral hepatitis and other STDs, such as most commonly chlamydia and gonorrhea. I usually add syphilis testing. We do have high rates of syphilis where I live. Hence, we generally test for syphilis as well, in addition to chlamydia and gonorrhea. Our NPEP is a 28-day course, and it's usually a three-drug antiretroviral regimen. Most commonly, we'll use an integrase strand inhibitor, dolutegravir or raltegravir, plus either Truvada, mostly Truvada, which is, again, emtricitabine and tenofovir disoproxil fumarate. Alternatively, you can do darunavir plus ritonavir and Truvada. And I have used Prazista, which here is darunavir and cobicistat, plus Truvada.
Would the choice of drug be based on the risk of the exposure, or how do you make that decision?
It depends. It depends on if they knew the individual and if that individual was HIV positive and on an antiretroviral treatment. So let's say they had sex with a known HIV partner who had a detectable viral load and knew this individual was on certain drugs. We would, you know, consider that person's regimen.
Mm-hmm.
But for just empiric PrEP, it really has to do with insurance coverage and cost of the patient. Truvada is much easier for us to obtain in the clinic at little to no cost to the patient, as well as raltegravir. And so it's chosen because of ease of tolerability of taking raltegravir and integrase inhibitors in general,
mm-hmm.
meaning least side effects of antiretrovirals, and then Truvada being easier to obtain.
Okay. All right, great.
I'll add that we do have something here called 340B pricing. And basically, a healthcare facility can sign up to be a 340B facility. And what this means is the federal government will provide funding so that that pharmacy or clinic can provide significantly reduced cost of antiretrovirals to patients. This only applies in the outpatient setting, so oral medications that can be attained at an outpatient pharmacy. So that's usually, part of why we choose what we choose to be able to be cost effective to a patient and have the least side effects.
Right. Okay, got you. So then the next scenario, Ankita, is that your patient now actually tests positive. So what would the opportunistic infections be that you'd most commonly see in your newly diagnosed patients, particularly those who come in with a low CD4 count in the US? And perhaps do you want to give that as a general, or can I go through a few scenarios with you?
Either or, and I can't wait to listen to this question when you do ask our South African counterpart. I'm very interested in hearing what you will see over there, but I can certainly answer. I'll let you give me the scenarios, and I can also talk about a little bit more of what I see here.
Okay, so say the patient comes in presenting with hypoxic pneumonia.
Yeah, so here, I think the most common thing we see is pneumocystis pneumonia. So we call it PJP, pneumocystis jirovecii. But that is the most common. Because of where I live, which is close to our border with Mexico, we do tend to see more tuberculosis than other parts of the states. For instance, I trained in Connecticut, which is a northern northeast state here, and I saw very little tuberculosis. But when I moved to California, I saw much more tuberculosis in our HIV patients. And then we also tend to see Mycobacterium avium complex, but I would say in terms of hypoxemia, it's definitely pneumocystis.
Okay, great. And then what about a patient presenting with chronic meningitis?
So most of the time we'll see Cryptococcus, but we also do see Toxoplasma as well as tuberculous meningitis.
Right. Okay. Then, still on the theme of the central nervous system, what about patients who present with focal neurological signs?
This one I can say could be a variety, but what I've seen most often is CNS syphilis as well as PML. Like I told you, we have higher rates of syphilis here. So I think we tend to see a lot more complications related to undiagnosed syphilis, especially with our HIV patients. But PML is another one that I do see more frequently.
Okay, interesting. And then the last scenario would be a patient presenting with disseminated skin lesions.
I've seen a whole host of infectious diseases related to skin lesions, but most commonly has been Kaposi's sarcoma. And then I would say, we did have Mpox. And so, of course, Mpox lesions, but Kaposi's sarcoma is definitely number one.
Great. So listeners are going to have to keep an ear and an eye out to see what the differences are between what is seen in the US and what is seen in South Africa when you have the South African episode.
And I will add, because, and again, like I said earlier, it also does depend on where you live here in the United States. So, for instance, in the Southwest United States where I live, we see a lot of coccidioid mycosis. And so I've definitely managed many coccidioid mycosis cases in our HIV population. And then I would say when I lived in the Northeast, I definitely saw more cases of histoplasmosis.
Okay, great. Thanks for that addition.
Just out of interest, as I've never seen one, how do patients with coccidioid mycosis present most commonly?
It's usually fever. It can be fever and cough. You can have pulmonary coccidioid mycosis. But in our HIV patients, we tend to see disseminated disease. And so disseminated disease usually goes to bone and can occur as meningitis. So, and I've also had cases that presented like miliary TB. So the X-ray looked like miliary TB, but it ended up being coccidioid mycosis. So mostly pulmonary and bone and meningitis.
That's really fascinating. All right. So, moving back to our patient, we're fortunate and initial testing doesn't show any opportunistic infections. How would you go about and think about initiating that patient on antiretroviral therapy? So are there, besides the HIV diagnosis, you know, are there any other tests you would do, maybe baseline resistance testing?
Yes, great question. We definitely would do baseline resistance testing. We normally do a complete blood count and a chemistry profile, mostly for the blood urea, nitrogen, and creatinine, making sure kidney function looks good. We also include glucose and an A1C, a hemoglobin A1C. We check liver enzymes usually urinalysis, looking for protein. And then viral hepatitis panel, so looking for hepatitis A, B, and C. We do a baseline lipid panel and then a CD4 count and viral load. If we're considering abacavir in the regimen, then we'd also do an HLA B5701.
Okay. Just out of interest, do you often see transmitted resistance with your baseline resistance testing?
Not often. And mostly it will be in individuals who are treatment experienced, and if they had poor adherence and are coming back into care, we might see the baseline resistance. But for the most part, even with individuals, for instance, I've had individuals who had started antiretrovirals, fell out of care, either, you know, due to lack of insurance or for other reasons, they would most often convert to wild type virus. And that's normally what we would see on baseline resistance testing.
Okay.
So, Nkita, we're not going to go into all of the details of the guidelines on, you know, which first, second, third line regimens to be treating the patients with. We thought we'd move slightly aside of that and talk about whether injectable antiretroviral therapy is routinely available in the US as an option, you know, kind of outside of the clinical trial setting.
It is, but and so there would be cabotegravir plus rilpivirine, you know, rilpivirine being the oral lead-in, and then the cabotegravir. But it is available, but it's not recommended for initial antiretroviral therapy. So initiating someone with a detectable viral load, we would not use this regimen. They have to achieve viral suppression on an oral regimen first before we could switch them to the cabotegravir. And then again, also depends on insurance coverage. There is patient assistance from the pharmaceutical company that makes the drug, but you know, this it still can be at cost to the patient.
Right.
And then the other thing I'll say is I think this is probably important, and you may see this more in South Africa in terms of HIV-2. As we know, HIV-2 is intrinsically resistant to non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors or NNRTIs. Cabotegravir would not be recommended for people with HIV-2.
Right. Okay.
I'm quite interested in the routine care now after we've initiated a patient on ART and what how we'll follow up that patient. So I have a few questions kind of probing that, if that's all right, starting with, you know, what routine prophylaxis will you give to a patient, let's say, with a CD4 count of less than 100?
So we may use different drugs than what you have there, but in general, we would give prophylaxis for Mycobacterium avium complex. Usually we use azithromycin for the prophylaxis, and then we would also give prophylaxis for toxoplasma. And generally we use what we call Bactrim here. And I think in Africa, you may use clotrimoxazole, if I'm getting that correct, but it's TMP-SMX, trimethoprim sulfa. And we use that for prophylaxis.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think we all call it Bactrim, just, mm-hmm. I'm not actually sure what it says on the box.
I wasn't sure.
No. It's funny because our infectious disease professor is not such a fan of trade names for drugs. So every time Bactrim slips out, I get rapped across the knuckles, but we won't go into that. So just back to the monitoring side, how frequently would you perform a viral load and CD4 count while on ART?
After initiation of ART, we repeat CD4 count viral load And my clinic, I think we're probably a little more conservative and we do it at 2 weeks and 4 weeks, but it is usually then every 3 months. The guidelines here actually say every 6 months, but I find, if their CD4 count is low, we usually will do every 3 months. Sorry, let me correct that. The guidelines here say CD4 count below 300 to check every 3 months.
Okay. And the TB preventative therapy, is that quite routine, or do you do, for example, a QuantiFERON assay before offering it?
We do QuantiFERON assays, but with individuals with low CD4 counts, we may not always elicit that immune response with the QuantiFERON assay. So it's not standard of care to give in the US to give TB prevention to all patients with low CD4 count. We usually do test and offer LTBI treatment once active TB is ruled out. But I will say that we do repeat annual testing, and that's because if the CD4 count is low, we may not have initially caught it, right? Or know that until they've had a robust enough immune response. So it's usually checked once a year if they were negative in the previous year.
Okay. And just a last question on the routine monitoring. Are there any reflex laboratory tests associated with specific parameters? So, for example, in South Africa, if the CD4 is less than 100 on a request, then a reflex cryptococcal antigen test gets added and done. So are there any kind of laboratory reflex tests like that in the US?
No, we don't have reflex testing. It would basically be symptom based if we were going to order the cryptococcal antigen. So I'd say it depends on CD4 count, and we do look for OIs. And I would say the only other test that we are doing is reflex test. If someone is very severely immunocompromised, that they might have, for instance, a low white blood cell count, then we would monitor their absolute neutrophil count. But I really think it depends on patient profile. So I wouldn't say that we had reflex testing, but we would order based on the individual patient and what we were seeing with that patient.
Thanks, Ankita. So let's look a little bit further down the line and assume that we've been following this patient up for about 5 years now with virological suppression documented throughout. But all of a sudden, the latest HIV viral load is 2,000 copies per milliliter. And a repeat 3 months thereafter, with adherence counseling included as well, is still greater than 1,000 copies per mil. Your patient is being treated with tenofovir, emtricitabine, and dolutegravir. What would your next steps be in this sort of scenario?
This is a really good question, and I wanted to start off first with in our clinic, to prevent these kind of scenarios, we built in something called wraparound services to give patients the easiest access to services that would hopefully help them to be adherent to their medications. So we have, for instance, pharmacists and pharmacy services, mental health, including psychiatrists, drug addiction counselors, social workers to help assist with housing or financial needs, all within the same clinic space as our clinicians that are seeing these patients. And we do see non-adherence or poor adherence and do speak with these individuals first to try to understand what the barrier might be. It could be something such as drug-drug interactions that they were unaware of, adherence factors like recreational drug use. And it could also be something such as a night shift job that interferes with the timing of their antiretroviral. And
Right.
I've even heard, stigma, right? Some of my patients didn't want to take their medications in front of their family, due to stigma. And so we try to work with the patients, each individual patient to find the root cause and then address it. But, basically, if this viral load remained elevated after trying to address the root cause, we would do resistance testing, to see if this individual had developed any resistance. And of course, the dolutegravir you mentioned, well, this is an integrase strand inhibitor, it's transfer inhibitor. And so there can be, I think, more easily with missed doses, resistance occurring. So we definitely would have to do resistance testing to determine if they had developed resistance and choose a new regimen.
So let's say we did do resistance, and this is, a as we said, a few years down the line, and we get our resistance report back, and the patient has high level resistance to integrase inhibitors, protease inhibitors, NNRTIs, and NNRTIs. Are there any options that are available in the US for these extreme resistance profiles where it just seems like everything is out?
Well, first, I'd, you know, definitely want to talk to the patient about their adherence and try to eliminate any factors that were going to cause adherence issues, because it doesn't matter what drug you give, right? And if they're still going to have difficulty with adherence, we have to address that barrier first. But we do have drugs that may have novel mechanisms of action that the patient may not have received before. There are post-attachment inhibitors like ibalizumab. I think I had one patient on ibalizumab. There are GP120 attachment inhibitors like fostemsavir. There are fusion inhibitors. I've used T20, which is an old drug. I can never say it, infavirtide. And then one I've used often, but we do have to check is CCR5, or antagonist maraviroc. That's probably the one I've used the most in individuals who can take maraviroc. But we do have to check if they have CXCR4 or CCR5, a mechanism. So those are the drugs that we have available, and probably the ones we'd use more in a multi-drug resistant individuals. If there was a clinical trial, I would probably look to make sure I had a backup and maybe be able to enroll a patient into the clinical trial. But I'd say maraviroc or T20 or ibalizumab are the ones that we use the most.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think maraviroc is my favorite drug name. It just it sounds like a transformer or something.
They should have called it Maverick, not maraviroc. Okay, everyone. I think we're coming just about to the end of the episode. So, Ankita, normally before we ask you for a take-home message, we have something called a spotlight feature. And today's spotlight feature, you're going to be playing a little game. Ruwan has put together a short little quiz question for you.
Okay. I feel nervous.
That's right up your alley. You'll be fine.
So my quiz question is, what was HIV's name before it was called HIV?
I think it was SIV, right? Simian immunovirus. Am I wrong? Was it SIV?
I had to look this up today, so it's a bit of an unfair question. But yeah, so HIV was like a zoonotic crossover from SIV. But when it was first described, it was actually called HTLV-3, which is really interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah, well, at least I think it's interesting. I don't know if anyone else thinks it's interesting. But yeah, that was my quiz question.
Awesome. I think we've all kind of learned something. I didn't know that either, so that's news for me. I thought there was only ever one HTLV. Are there many?
Well, there's two. I thought there was two HTLV, so that's why I find that interesting that they would have called this HTLV-3.
Okay, interesting.
But it's not the same virus.
No. But I guess I'm not sure what the basis was for that. But the other name that it had was lymphadenopathy associated virus initially, which
yeah.
that makes sense because, you know, they probably would have picked up the patients with seroconversion illness, which, I mean, lymphadenopathy being quite prominent.
This was all before sequencing became available, and that's perhaps why it got lumped with the wrong group of viruses, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and it's also just interesting for me to think back. I mean, people maybe in now in 50 years' time are going to have a podcast episode and ask, you know, what was SARS-CoV-2's initial name, you know? And what did we initially call it? 29 NCOV 2019, or
yeah.
I forget now. I mean, it's not even been that long, and
we've already forgotten. Yeah. Ankita, do you have a quick or last minute take home messages for our listeners?
Just keep listening to your podcast because I
awesome.
Hear it.
Thank you for that. That's amazing. And so just out of interest, Almost half of our audience or our regular listeners actually are from the US, and the other half of the regular listeners are South African. So if you are one of our US regular listeners, this is a quick shout out to you. Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting the show. And Kipa, thank you so much for joining us today. It was really insightful. It was incredible to hear it from the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. And yeah, it'll be really great to have you on the show again sometime in the future.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, remember to give us your feedback either by email or on social media. Don't forget to add that 5-star rating and remember to follow, like, and share. So that's it from me, your microbe messenger, as well as Ruwan, Vinita, Nonkululeko, and Esther. We'll see you again soon with more Contagious Mail.